10th. Morning fog is burning off. Look for a cloudy day today. 50-50 chance of some rain developing. And a high today heading for 78 degrees. Right now, pretty good cloud cover. New numbers in, 73 for Kenosha, 69 for Racine, 66 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. This summer, my wife and I had the opportunity to journey out west and explore some of the most beautiful places in the USA. And for the first time, actually, in my life, I got to experience the beauty of Yellowstone. And also, for the first time, I got to view Mount Rushmore. And so you can understand why I am exceptionally thrilled at the opportunity to speak with someone about a book which very directly addresses the creation of Mount Rushmore, albeit in a very intriguing and highly personal way. By sheer coincidence, I have the opportunity to speak today with the author of a book called Love Letters from Mount Rushmore, The Story of a Marriage, a Monument, and a Moment in History. The author, Richard Sarasani, has an interesting connection to Mount Rushmore. His father, Arthur, worked on Mount Rushmore towards the very end of its completion. And Richard Sarasani, not all that long ago, discovered a trunk in his mother's attic, and in that trunk was a treasure trove of letters between his parents when his father Arthur was off in far western South Dakota working on Mount Rushmore, leaving back home his wife and their two very young children, one of whom was Richard. And in those extraordinary letters, we have not only the story of an intense love story between this this husband and wife, but also we get a chronicle of the very, very difficult conditions under which the work was done on Mount Rushmore. It's an incredibly interesting book and very much a unique story. And it is published by the South Dakota State Historical Society Press. And I am so excited to have this opportunity to speak with its author, Richard Sarasani, the son of Arthur Sarasani. He has been a professional actor for much of his life, and he was for a number of years the villain Bill Watson on the soap opera General Hospital. And among other notable items on his resume, was a starring role in the national tour of the highly regarded play Butterflies Are Free. Again, this is Richard Sarasani's book, Love Letters from Mount Rushmore. Richard Sarasani, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to talk to you, Greg, and your audience. It comes to me as a shock. I didn't plan to finish in the late years of my life as an author, but I stumbled on this trunk, which I didn't know existed. No one did. Mother had passed away just before. Dad had passed away earlier. And to open this trunk and to find the history of our country covered with romance and just interesting facts. Actually, the heads of the models of the president and all this memorabilia stuff just blew my mind and really has occupied me the last few years of my life, maybe more like 5 or 6 of years of life, putting it down for posterity because it belongs to the history of the United States. It's a fascinating story, and it's told by the letters. It's not told by an author in the sense that the historian comes along and wants you to think the way he does. It's absolutely, you put the puzzle together.
Right. This is very much told in first person. In the prologue to the book, you mentioned something about the fact that you knew that your father had this connection to Mount Rushmore, and as a matter of fact, on a memorable occasion, took some of his most priceless memorabilia regarding Mount Rushmore to school as part of what I'm sure was, in your mind, quite a spectacular show-and-tell presentation. But tell our listeners what happened, the sad thing that happened in the wake of that.
Well, the moment of glory was swiftly departing. Departed within a week. I felt like a hero. The teacher treated me like a star because my father had worked out there and had all this stuff. But somewhere between the house and the school in Rochester, New York, it disappeared. And I thought, I literally lived with the guilt for 50, 60 years exactly, that I had lost the heritage of my parents, all the records and everything. And this trunk basically restored my life. I mean, it's covered in the first chapter of the book that I stumbled on this chest that I didn't know. A 2 month, there's a special word for an old trunk or something like that. And it restored me because, by the way, even though those pictures and stuff were, you know, either taken, disappeared, or what, there were negatives in there. They were the actual bust of the presidents. And, of course, the love letters, well, I call them love letters because it was two people commuting back and forth over maybe 1,500 miles and telling what was going on and how they missed. And my mother being a tremendous support of my father, and my dad was just very disappointed. The conditions he found in Mount Rushmore, it was more like a mining camp, or that he was in a third world nation. And she said, you do what's expected of you. It'll take time, but working for famous people, and is this way you do? They want to see what you can do. So he went as a sculptor, and he was asked, his first job was to survey the mountain stuff. And he said, I've never surveyed anything in my life. I'm an artist. She said, she sent him books. She said, you do what is asked of you, and in time it'll all work out. And that's what the story is, an achievement of human nature, fighting the conditions, and then eventually everything working out. It's a fascinating story.
It really is. Story. And, of course, it's all the more wonderful the circumstances under which you stumble upon this trunk. You weren't looking for it. You didn't even know it existed. You were, well, remind me, what was it that brought you up into that remote attic?
Yeah, I went in the attic because I'm a history buff, and I was told my mother. Now, my dad, remember, he came by way of Italy, then to Brazil, and then here. They were immigrants. The mother and dad didn't even speak English. And mother was basically very blue-blooded and everything. And I didn't know that she had been a pack rat and saved everything there. And I had gone up there hearing that she had been a member of the Daughters of the American Revolution, and I was going to find this flag, and I was going to mount it, and it was part of my history, interest in history. And I never found that flag. I found a Patriots flag given as honor of helping out with World War II, but I never did find that flag. So that's one of the unsolved mysteries that may still be lurking someplace in some hidden spot in the attic. That's why I say, what's in your attic? What's in your basement? There may be history there. Maybe not Mount Rushmore, but there's something, because everybody had relative fighting in the Civil War, et cetera. So always know what you got and don't be afraid to take the time to look.
Right. We're speaking with Richard Sarasani about a brand new book called Love Letters from Mount Rushmore, The Story of a Marriage, a Monument, and a Moment in History. Richard Sarasani's father, Arthur, worked on Mount Rushmore in the last couple of years of its completion or near completion, and this book is for the most part a collection of the extraordinary, passionate, beautiful letters which his parents exchanged while they were separated during that period. The book is also rich with all kinds of fascinating photographs as well that help tell the story of Mount Rushmore. Actually, in the first chapter of the book, you, in a sense, introduce us to your two parents, Arthur Sarasani and Mary Groh, who meet in 1935 and eventually are married. There are interesting ways in which they were both apparently very compatible with one another. I mean, they were always happily married, and yet there were intriguing differences between them, differences which also seemed to lead their respective families to be more dismayed than happy that they wanted to marry each other. Tell us a little bit about the two of them as individuals. What made them similar? What made them different? And why there was such unhappiness surrounding their marriage? I mean, not that they were unhappy, but the people around them, for the most part, were unhappy at the prospect of them being married.
Yeah. Well, the old theory that you've got to be careful, oil and water don't mix or whatever, came to effect because there's quotes from the diary of my mother saying, gee, my sister said, oh, my gosh, you're going to marry that guy. You're going to have, excuse me using the word, 18 little wops running around behind you or something like that, because there was a difference. I mean, I always say the Irish and the English were fighting for the low rung of the ladder. And Dad, coming from another country, basically, although he was first generation, he lived in a section of town that Mother probably wouldn't have lived in there because her father was an oil man. And they struggled, too. They had their own struggles. They had to worry about oil at, I think, $1.75 a barrel. Now we complain at what we're paying, but at that time wasn't. So they were trying to keep their function going. So everybody has their struggles, but at different levels. But to read some of the comments in there, things that she fought, and Mother was very consistent. She said, I married you because of your great, great sensibilities, your artistic abilities, everything like that. And then she insisted that he live up to the challenge of Mount Rushmore, because Mount Rushmore was no walk in the park. It was like basically a mining camp. And he wasn't doing what he expected. I'm an artist. I'm a sculptor. What do you mean I'm to survey the mountain? I'm afraid of heights. And you've got all those pictures, and I've never been seen before, of him testing the rocks, walking along there, saying they're laughing at me because I have to go up in a belt to inspect the nose of Washington or Lincoln or something like that. So it's a fascinating story of a person overcoming fears, of prejudice for everything, and it shows the human spirit. If it's on the right track, we'll do the right thing.
Over the years, how much did your father talk about his work on Mount Rushmore with you? I mean, how important was this in his life, and as he looked back on what he did? I mean, he accomplished more than what he did on Mount Rushmore through the course of his life. But how did he regard it?
Well, very little. We talked very little about it. I didn't know this trunk existed. I didn't know Mom was, excuse me, a pack rat and kept every little communications, every little model of the mountain, et cetera, et cetera. But he believed in using art as a vehicle to bring people out of their own problems, even whether it be old age, whether it be the TBS asylum, the different homes. And he used art where he would give great hope to older people, because he said everybody can paint, everybody if they learn the principle, then you know you can become a modernist, you could be an impressionist, you could be everything. But if you know the principles, and that's what he devoted his life to. We had a studio in the attic, and he never sat around and talked about Mount Rushmore, what a great thing. He said it was a wonderful engineering feat, et cetera, et cetera. And it was just part of his life. And Mother herself, she ended up in the Peace Corps serving people. First at 70, she went to Thailand. And then after Thailand, and my brother's wife had given birth, after she completed the Thailand thing, she returned home. And then she went to Poland at 80 years old. Now, she got sick when she was 80 in Poland and didn't finish her term in the Peace Corps at 80. But we have letters from, in this case, Ronald Reagan, thanking her for her service and everything. They both continued in life. They didn't rest on their laurels. So it's a very uplifting story. They had challenges, but they met the challenges. And you get a feeling that through no historian telling you what to think, you sort of solve the problem yourself because you have their letters and communications. You say, oh, my gosh. They did this, they did that, but with pictures that some of the pictures have never been seen before this book was published. So I feel very grateful to be the messenger bringing a very uplifting story, and I'm just part of it. I don't take any credit. It's just that I was a lucky guy, found this trunk, and I mean, you know, and had some years left in my life because I know young chickens, spring chicken, which is a...
It is an uplifting story, but we should say that the primary events that play out in this book happen in the wake of what are very difficult first years for your parents' marriage. It's, of course, the 1930s. It's the Great Depression, and they have terrible financial struggles.
Yeah.
And that is certainly part of the story. And to some extent, those struggles even continue on into this period that involves Mount Rushmore. Just say a word about just how hard life was for them, and maybe how you came to understand the dimensions of your parents' difficulties all these years later.
I couldn't believe it. Mother was selling all occasion greeting cards door to door. Dad was shoveling snow, and he was working at night as a supplying the replacement of clothing in a store at night. Anything to get money together because they had lost their house, their apartment, I should say, because they. So they had each moved in with their individual parents and then visited on the weekends because Dad was better looking for work in Rochester, New York, and Mother stayed with her family, which is Avon, New York, which is about 20, 25 miles outside of Rochester. So they struggled. And if I had known all those things, I know I had good parents, but what they went through to make it work for me, boy, am I tell you, am I fortunate. You know, I had been lucky to have the right combination. Now, Mother went to South Dakota right to the monument and said, the family should be together. Parents, kids need their parents. And she went to the mountain, and he knew she was going to come sometime, but she just picked up, left the kids with relatives, and lived in a tent because there was no place for people there. They weren't there housing. There was no tourism at that time. And she lived in a tent. Had to use a bucket of water to bathe every day. That's all. And had to go up the hill to go to the bathroom. And she struggled, but she looked at it, and she found a way of taking tourists at 25 cents a piece up the hill and showing them the Mount Rushmore, showing them around the heads of the presidents. And by that way, she started earning more money than my dad, who was a sculptor and an artist. And it's just fascinating how they combined their resources and put things together, and it's all in the book. I kept a record of it, so you know what it's like from her letters, living in a tent and have to turn off the lights because of bugs at night and the heat of the day. And it's just filled with the true story told by the people that lived it.
Right. I don't think we've yet touched on how your father actually connected initially with Gutzon Borglum, who is the man primarily responsible for designing and carrying out to fruition this extraordinary Mount Rushmore monument. Explain to our listeners how the two of them first crossed paths, how Mr. Borglum found your father and, in a sense, asked something of him, which in turn led to this assignment at the Mount Rushmore site.
Yes. Gutz and Borglum happened to be visiting Rochester, New York at a time, and actually all this was new to me, that he was making a bust of Frank Gannett. Now, Frank Gannett is the guy who developed USA Today. He also owned the Democrat Chronicle paper. And Gutz and Borglum was there to make a bust of him because he was going to be running for president of the United States. And it's so very funny to read about it because it was sort of parallel. I mean, history repeats itself, like Romney ran to be president. And some people would say, well, just because he's rich doesn't mean he'd make a good president. So Gutz and Borglum was there to help Frank Gannett. And he said, I need a good artist. I need an artist to help me. Well, my dad was at his dad's house during the week, and a knock came at the door, and the guy introduced himself saying, look, I hear there's an artist that lives here, and I'm Gutz and Borglum. Well, Gutz and Borglum was pretty famous even at that time, 1940. He was well known, and he said, I hear there's an artist. I need help. And my dad quite luckily started working for me. Gutz and Borglum liked him, had my dad finish the head, ship it off to New York City, and said, by the way, I want you to come work for me. I can make you, basically what he was saying, translating, I can make you famous. I said, you by working alongside me, there with his lunching papers, to only find out that Gutz and Borglum didn't meet him. He was staying on a train track, at a train station, which is now a pizza parlor in Rapid City, South Dakota, and he waited until 4:15 that night from 6:15 in the morning to get to this camp, which was basically a mining camp, and the first words out of Gutz and Borglum's son's mouth were, I'm going to have you, my dad's going to have you survey the mountain, and my dad said, in his mind, I've never surveyed anything. I'm an artist, a sculptor. So he wrote the first letter to his wife, and she said, look, you do what's expected of you. You learn, you wait your time, you show your value. And she sent him off books on how to survey. I mean, it's just filled with interesting things and struggles is what people did. And, of course, no one knows this. Really, they don't realize it unless I saw the movie 2 years ago that Bruce Dern did, that this whole thing was brought to a close by two villains. The villains at that time were Hitler and Mussolini. It never was completed. Dad was sent home not having completed what he had gone out there to work on, the Hall of the Springs, the Hall of Records, that Gutz and Borglum planned, and the staircase and everything, because they ran out of money. And it was because of what was going on in Europe.
One of the most interesting things about the first letters that your father writes to your mother back home is as he describes the horrendous conditions in which he finds himself. And there seem to be several facets of the conditions there that were especially upsetting to him. And he's over and over again pleading with his wife, please don't come after me. Please don't come here. Right. This would be a terrible place for you and the two children to be. Help us understand just how terrible these conditions were.
Well, it was basically like a third world nation, like a mining camp. My relative had written, actually my mother's brother had written, he was exploring for oil in Venezuela. And he described the conditions of an oil camp, and believe me, it wasn't a pretty situation. And my dad refers to it as sort of like Uncle Junior. He had said conditions that he faced. It was the people in the first place. It was a very dangerous thing to be up on a mountain where people were blasting. There wasn't running water, so they had to go into to the city 30 miles away if they wanted to take a bath, unless they sponge bathed like my mother, because my mother got there. She ended up sponge bathing every day and, again, living in a tent. And they drank heavy like miners were, and they were absolutely shocked that my dad was away from home. And the girls liked him. He was a good-looking man, and he wasn't interested in it. And he wrote to Mother, and I call it the Faust connection because of the opera or the literature of Faust, because he had Mother had gone to see it at the Eastman School of Music. And so I correlated together. I said, it was the Faust condition. She said, you don't have to worry about it. And his poetry to writing my mother and describing what was going on in his life and how he missed her were just, oh, my gosh, if I could have written that way, I would have been a writer. Now, I just feel I'm just complying. I'm sort of the person put the vehicle together. But, boy, to be able to write the poetry my dad write in between what he was doing was just absolutely, it's enjoyable just to read it. I mean, I could quote you and your audience, my darling wife, if anybody has ever made such a lonely man, there's no one but me. And then he describes how she had explained about nature and how nature in its very coldness, its darkness, can't be as lonely as this. And I could actually read it, I think, on page 42 I could read it to you, but I know your time is...
I actually happen to have that letter right in front of me, and I think it's absolutely wonderful. This is what he writes. My most adorable wife, darling, if God ever made a lonesome man, one whose very heart is breaking, he made me. Never have I missed or longed for anything or anybody as I do now. Now I realize what you meant. Nature with its beauty cannot replace the hunger for human life. It really is cruel. Its very silences hurt the ears. Its bigness destroys our sense of balance. What extremes are these? By the way, as beautifully as he expresses his feelings there, this does bring to mind a fascinating point that you make a little later in the book, the fact that your father never went to college, and that for all the passion that we find in these letters and kind of homespun eloquence, he is also someone with somewhat spotty grammatical skills.
Yes.
And this is something which your mother would point out to him in certain letters, to the point where your father would sometimes pull back, probably hurt, wondering if he should even write letters to his wife if she's going to find fault with them. And, of course, you look closely and see great love in the criticism which she sometimes gives to her husband about the manner in which he writes. Tell us more about that.
Well, that's true. He was, even to the day, he passed away, he was always concerned that he didn't have a college education, and that always, it was embarrassing to him. To me, my gosh, if I could write that way, I would have been a full-time writer and done very well. But he had great passion, and he sort of, I don't want to say hid that fact, but he always realized that was he thought a strike against him. And yet, he helped more people in this world than I could, we were three brothers. We all could, all our efforts together, what he was able to do, and with his he felt, limited ability. Oh, my gosh, the way he wrote and everything was not limited. He was worried about spelling and grammar. And he always thought it would reflect bad on him if he did. So he was very cautious and shy, and to the day he passed away, concerned that he had never taken a college education. Now, nowadays, people would go back. You read in stories or you hear, I just heard some of the last week about a football player at 72, a Hall of Famer. He went and picked up his degree or something, but Dad would have loved to do that because he was a learned man. Oh, he loved to read the books of Michelangelo, the Italian greats and everything. He read a lot, but he didn't have the formal education because he was one of seven kids, and they were more interested in surviving in the new world. He would go picking up vegetables. They would hide him so he could work in a factory to get money for the family, because a family of nine, counting the parents, was quite a burden for immigrants. But they did. They struggled. It's a very uplifting story. It's not any bit depressing, but it's so great to see how families deal with what they're given. I always say, I'm a card player. I can only deal from the hand that has been given me, and then I must make the most of it. And he certainly did.
Right. And as for your mother's criticism of your father, sometimes less than ideal grammatical expression as he wrote these letters, I mean, she is, of course, doing so for his own good. And this is an excerpt from one of her letters to him. "Darling, if I talk about your letters, it is for your own good. I would love you just as much if you made 1 million mistakes. But others don't forgive, and they are very harsh in their judgment. You have a wonderful opportunity right now to learn to write correctly and spell correctly. There will come a time when you will have to write an important letter and won't have time to send it to me for a checkup. Then when you are censured, you will wish you had taken my advice. Sometimes," and she goes on to say, "sometimes I really can't make out your meaning. A little extra time and pains would correct that, and it would be well worth the time and effort. I don't criticize to be mean, but to help you avoid trouble in the future, dear. Your letters are a wonderful help to me. I look forward to them each day and am very disappointed if I don't receive one." I think what's so cool about a letter like that is it reminds us of the complexity of human relationship and the fact that when you really love somebody, it really isn't about whatever you do is just fine with me because I just love you anyway. That there is an aspect of love that is a little more complicated than that, and that is when we want the best for the person that we love, and that sometimes means telling them, you know, you have spinach in your teeth, or you really made a fool of yourself last night at that party, or whatever. And this is lived out so vividly for us, the readers, in these letters that you've chosen.
Well, that's absolutely. Thank you for pointing that thing, that passage, that letter out, because there is a lot of things. There's a lot of letters that I have not, I haven't given to the people to the publisher. But I mean, I could start a book, and it was where this is called Love Letters. From Mount Rushmore, I could say love letters to Mount Rushmore and say the woman's point of view, because I'm telling you, she had such good advice about telling and coaching them and supporting them. So I'm thinking of, you know, I'm thinking, because writing a book is quite a difficult thing, and I would like to get a name writer, which people look forward to, say, Mary Higgins Clark's next book or something like that, where life is a teeter-totter, and a good relationship is like a teeter-totter. It's not a woman following behind a man. Mother gave such good advice. I got one passage. I'm going to mark that passage you read, because I think it's a wonderful example of mother's love and depth. But there's one where she says, "I'm not going to do what's expected of me. The kids need their parents and they need the attention. It's a hot day. I'm not going to can the beans, what's expected of me, and can the tomatoes. I'm going to take them out to the lake." And I mean, there's so many beautiful passages that I could really fill a book with passage of a woman's part in the role, etc. So I'm going to mark that passage, because the one you just pointed out was wonderful. And you sometimes don't have times and interviews to put in everything you'd like to, but that really should be part of an interview on my part, where the shows that it's a teamwork, it's a balancing act, and that's why I say the teeter-totter. Thank you for that, because that gives me some wonderful thoughts, because I am doing interviews now, and since running around, I mean, I've been to this past winter or two, where I sometimes return not being completely well, because, you know, I you know, let's face it, I'm no young chicken. 77 in October, because it was my dad that worked there, you know, so I'm on there. But I got to have those passages put out. And I, if I may, with your permission, the sense that you pointed out to me, that should be always there when I have extra time in an interview to point it out, because, boy, that says it all.
That's a wonderful letter. It really, really is.
Yes, teamwork.
Some of
can
what
you said. Can I ask you what page it is so I can look it up as soon as I hang up?
Absolutely. It's in the 70s.
Okay.
That letter is page 76, 77.
Oh, thank you, boy.
You bet.
I tell you, you helped me with my own work. Thank
you.
Yeah,
no problem. When you talk about what your father was able to make of himself being an Italian-American immigrant, it also brings to mind a chapter in the book which caught me very much by surprise, chapter 15, titled Mother's Growing Concern. And one of the things that we are reminded from time to time is that the primary events of this book, of course, play out against the mounting horror of World War II,
yeah.
At a time when America wasn't yet directly involved, but it was on the horizon. And the situation, of course, was a very sensitive one in that your father was Italian-American and at least early on had some admiration for Benito Mussolini, and some of his relatives were even more unguarded in their expressions of fascination and even admiration for him. Tell us more about that and the way in which your mother really acted pretty aggressively to try to caution your father in particular to be much more judicious in what he thought and said about someone like Mussolini.
Absolutely. Now, just across the border, I mean, they were from Rochester, New York. They were rounding up Italians because they were very upset about Texas. We had a tendency in this country to round up the Japanese, but it was a very sensitive subject. And Mother was afraid that not only, you know, because he's struggling as an immigrant, but because he comes from a land where they do admire Mussolini, this could be very dangerous to him and everything. So she would say, you know, please keep your mouth closed. You know, I don't talk politics, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, what I point out always is that every section of history has their enemies. Now, right now, our enemy seems to be ISIS because ISIS is doing what they're doing. But at that time, it was Hitler and Mussolini, and it was a very controversial subject because some people thought, oh my gosh, Mussolini and Hitler, these are great men, and especially Dad's family, some of the kids in the family thought Mussolini was a great man, and if Dad started to say something about it, Mother said, my, you've got to be watch your tongue because you're in a very crucial zone right now, and you don't need that kind of attention. Let those people fight among themselves or something, but you can't be a supporter. This person is not, well, she obviously said he's not a good person. These are not people that we admire. And you being an outsider in the sense that your whole family has come by way of Brazil, but from Italy to Brazil here, you've got to watch it. So there was a danger there. And, there were prejudices that existed all the time. I mean, I was a kid that the Irish and the Italians were fighting for the low rung on the ladder. So she was trying to say, Dad, you're a very open and loving person, and you'll talk about anything and everything, but you've got to know how to guard your tongue. Now, Mother being a teacher, school teacher, she had great wisdom and said, you've got to be careful. And so she was That's what she was preaching to him. Watch your tongue. Be friends with everybody, but close to none, because she did not want on the mountain them to, you know, start prejudicing against him because he was Italian. And I tell you, being Italian at this time in history was not a popular thing, especially when Mussolini joined with Hitler and they became partners, you know.
Mm. We're speaking with Richard Serasani, and we're talking about his book, Love Letters from Mount Rushmore, The Story of a Marriage, a Monument, and a Moment in History. The book is made up primarily of beautiful love letters written between the author's parents, the mom back home with the two young children, while the father, Arthur Serasani, was in the Black Hills of South Dakota, helping to complete Mount Rushmore. Let's just talk for a moment about the actual work which your father did on Mount Rushmore. And it's probably important for us to clarify, for the sake of those who don't know, that work on Mount Rushmore actually began in the late 1920s. So by the time your father got to Mount Rushmore, to a large extent, the monument had been completed. I mean, most of the photographs, I would say all the photographs that we see, it's unmistakably Mount Rushmore. I mean, it's not like Abraham Lincoln is missing his nose, or we don't yet have Theodore Roosevelt. I mean, all four figures are there, and it's really that the very final stages of just maybe the final polishing of the monument. Your father, as you've already mentioned, was actually initially hired to do surveying, something he had never done before. What's your understanding of the surveying that he was doing at that point, when the project was so close to completion anyway? What surveying work was there to do, and what purpose did it serve?
Yeah, well, actually, he never knew the word surveying. Now, that's one of his complaints. He says, Gutzon Borglum, in his early letters and his talking with my dad, said, come and work with me. Basically, I can make you famous. You'll be working alongside me and everything. When he got there, the son, Lincoln Borglum, said, your first task is to survey the mountain. And Dad really, well, I've never surveyed. Oh, I'm an artist. I'm a sculptor. I'm a painter, but I'm not a surveyor. But they were starting to wrap up the sense of what the whole thing was going to be like. And so Dad was asked to do the surveying. He didn't say, well, I can't do it. I never surveyed my life. He'd been hired, and he wanted that work. And so that's Mother fed him the book. He ended up in their original pictures of them there, facing his fears of the height of surveying and all that stuff. But he ended up really very negative about Gutzon Borglum. At first, I was a little bit afraid of sending those letters off to the people there at the mountain and everything, because they were very critical of Gutzon Borglum. Like, he promised a lot, but he didn't deliver, my dad felt. But Dad had to learn all these different things. And I think Dad, if you were describing him in today's term, you'd say he was more of a gopher of doing what Gutzon Borglum wanted to do. And Gutzon Borglum's word was, we've got to see what you can do first. And so Dad ended up doing a lot of things, but the one thing he hit on that Gutzon liked very much was, you can make heads, images of the heads, which we will sell to the tourists. And that's why they're in the trunk. And that's why it was so shocking to find so many things in the trunk. Dad had even a plaque that had Theodore Roosevelt, not Teddy Roosevelt. Of course, he had the heads of that. But I'm looking for a smoking gun that Gutzon Borglum was playing with, the idea of maybe involving Franklin D. Roosevelt on that mountain, although we know that Jefferson's, they had to change Jefferson's position on the mountain because of a fusion in the rock. So there was a lot of problems that happened there. And Dad was asked, oh my gosh, Dad complained. He had to help with the fixing of the new, what's it called, studio. By the way, there's an original picture there. My dad staying up on the, with another, sculptor Luigi Bianco, planning on how Gutzon Borglum wanted it completed. They, you know, originally wanted the guys to be developed all the way down to the waist. He wanted, I mean, he had a really great plan. It's in the book, actually, the picture there. And if you go to Mount Rushmore, you can go into the, I don't want to say the museum, but you know, the hall there, where they were developing the figures, and see that, as Bruce Stern in the movie Nebraska says, oh my gosh, what's the big fuss? Only one guy's got clothes on and one guy's missing an ear. So as soon as the government said, hey, we've got to, you know, it was off the record, start supporting our allies abroad, etc. London, England, they were all looking for the help of America. They stopped the work. They ran out of money. In my dad's last letter there, I think it was on September 18th, saying they've run out of money. They can't keep us going. We've been working basically for about, how many weeks and weeks without a salary. We're the only three guys left standing. He gave the name of the other two guys. All the workers had been dismissed because they couldn't pay for them. I always say it's sort of like that movie On the Waterfront with Marlon Brando, where he would show up looking to see if there was work on the docks that day. Well, the workers were showing up over the last couple months there saying, well, is there going to be work today? Are we can? Goetze Borgmann was out looking for money. I always call it, in modern day terms, begging for bucks. He was trying to get money, and people were now turning a deaf ear because money was scarce. We were coming out of a recession, and the government was now thinking in different directions, and they just said, hey, this is silly. We've got to not put any more money in there. So when Goodson unexpectedly died, okay, Lincoln Borglum was given some money by the government, just finish it up, polish it up, and everything like that, because they weren't going to do any more. And Lincoln Borglum in later life petitioned to have those figures finished like his dad wanted him to have them finished, because, you know, Borglum wanted it not to be, he wanted it to be a tribute to democracy. He didn't want it to be like, say, the Great Pyramid, where people always wondered, why is the Sphinx there? What's stored inside there? Maybe we've got to x-ray it. He wanted to have the record of the United States there, in a, not in a capsule, but in a museum behind the mountain. And it never got done because the villains, in this case it was Mussolini and Hitler, stopped the project, and they never went back to finish it. They just said, it's got to be as it is, and that was it. So my dad never got called back. He was, I'm sure, disappointed about it, but he never talked about it much. I learned all this stuff more from what was in the trunk. It was like, it was just amazing, you know.
I wonder... I assume that over the years you've had, I'm guessing, maybe repeated opportunities to actually go to Mount Rushmore. How do you experience that that beautiful monument, knowing that you have kind of a personal connection to it that the typical American, of course, does not? In what way does that affect the way in which you are moved by the sight of Mount Rushmore?
Well, what it has done for me is that when I go out there, I see more than those four great presidents. I literally think of my parents and the role they played. As short as it was, I mean, we're talking basically 6 months, 7 months, you call it, I mean, on either side amount of time, but very short time. And I realized that what has influenced me is we in life need heroes. Now, unfortunately, the media often projects people to be our heroes who are sports figures or something, who disappoint us, that, you know, that they're human, they make mistakes, they, you know, you hear about them fighting in a bar or hitting their spouse or loved ones in an elevator, and they don't live up to it. And here I say, my gosh, I've got two parents that I knew were good parents, but they're really my heroes. And we do need heroes in life. Mentors, call it what, you know, people will phrase it different ways. But I see my parents up there as part of it and having played part of it. And it's changed my life to the point where I realize the importance of having someone to look up to, someone to be part of it. And when it's your own family, well, it's lucky. Now, not everybody has that fortune. I mean, there's a lot of single families now and everything. But mother in her letter said, no, the kids need their parents. They need their dad. And she struggled to make sure that we had it. And my parents are my heroes. There's two more people up there. And I'm sure there's others that, you know, would qualify. But the four presidents and my mom and dad.
Well put. The book is such a wonderful testament to their abiding love for one another and for the way that they persevered through all kinds of great difficulties. The book again is called Love Letters from Mount Rushmore, The Story of a Marriage, a Monument, and a Moment in History. It is published by the South Dakota State Historical Society Press. It's a beautiful book, chock full of splendid photographs, and the author is Richard Sarasani. Richard Sarasani, I'm so glad we got to talk about your wonderful book, and I wish you very, very well and all that stretches ahead for you.
It's my pleasure, and I want to tell your audience how lucky they are. I'm now going to put in page 76 and 77 whenever.